Hi guys, I'm Dan Reed and welcome back to the Career Dad Show.
Chris Bishop's had 8 careers. Not jobs, careers. His band toured with the Eagles and ZZ Top. He then got into writing jingles, including Kit Kat's first TV advert. Chris then discovered the World Wide Web, learned programming, and landed a job with IBM where he worked on virtual worlds. Chris now teaches people how to prepare for jobs that don't yet exist. Get ready for a fantastic episode. Welcome back to the Career Dad Show, and I'm joined today by Chris Bishop. Chris, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. Delighted to be here.
No, I'm so pleased to have you here, and we've spoken a little bit just before we started recording. We spoke a little bit last week, and there are so many fascinating topics to cover, and we will try and get through them all. But, you know, when we spoke a few weeks ago, we had a fascinating conversation around the future of work and the future of jobs, and I definitely want to talk about that because I think it's so important. But before we do, I'd just love to know a little bit more about your own journey, because am I right in thinking that you've had 7 or 8 careers?
Yes, I have. I describe myself as a nonlinear multimodal careerist.
Okay.
And I say I've had 8 careers so far. And by that, I mean I've done things that friends or colleagues are still doing for a living. But then I've moved into sort of other kinds of roles. So that's kind of what I describe as a career, if you will.
Yeah, because I think it's – sorry to interrupt, because I think it could be easy just for people listening. Like, we're not talking about 7 or 8 jobs. We're talking about actual completely different fields of careers, right?
Yeah, I mean, so I see if I can keep this brief. I tend to be long-winded. But first of all, I have a degree in German literature from a small liberal arts school in Vermont. Right after graduating, I got a gig touring with a band called McKendry Spring. We opened for acts like the Eagles and ZZ Top. When the band broke up, I moved to New York and became a studio musician and toured with Robert Palmer and played with Chuck Berry and Bo Diddley. And then came off the road one time and realized I was done with the Holiday Inn dressing room circuit and wondered how I could sleep in my own bed at night. So I asked my musician friends in New York. They said, "Jingles, man, you got to break into the session scene." So I set about putting a reel together and reaching for anyone and everyone I knew in that business or even in adjacent businesses, and broke into the scene first as a bass player. I'm an electric bass player, and then as an arranger, and then a composer, and then a producer. So I ended up having my first real job at age 40, working at a jingle house, running a synclavier, which is a digital musical instrument that was sort of the state of the art at the time, writing music for television. And I wrote literally dozens and dozens of commercials for radio and TV. And then I saw this wacky thing in the early 90s, this technology called the World Wide Web started to appear. And so I became intrigued by it. I thought, well, this will, to be honest, I thought they'll probably need music. So maybe I can compose. I mean, I can't imagine that this web thing would be mute. As it turns out, 25 years later, it is mute and has been, except for like maybe Nickelodeon, Cartoon Network. For all you dads, that's where they use audio for cues and you know, navigation guidance or whatever. So anyway, I taught myself to be a web producer, took classes, went to New York Mac user group meetings in the city, read a lot of books, stayed up late surfing the web looking at code, hung out a shingle as a web producer, and got hired at a seminal interactive agency in New York City as a freelance web producer, and worked there and then at another company called Eagle River Interactive. And then, much to my surprise, based on meeting a woman on the train commuting into New York, I got an interview with and was hired by, drum roll, IBM.
Wow.
And I'm like, yeah, it was a dramatic change. So at 48, I went to work at a global 50 technology company as an account manager in their corporate internet programs. And did a lot of different things. Why was it IBM? Because as you can imagine, a company that big, lots of opportunity to do different things.
Sure.
And I just e-tired, using Big Blue parlance, about 7 years ago. And I've been working ever since as kind of a freelance writer, speaker. I give workshops at universities called How to Succeed at Jobs That Don't Exist Yet. And that's what we're going to talk about today, right? For all you dads getting ready for multiple careers. So.
Yeah, like you say, there are people who are still working in each of those fields. And
yes.
What do you think And I want to delve into a little bit of each of those, but what do you think has been the toughest jump from one career into the other?
Well, I would say probably making the leap, and this, my wife would corroborate this, right, honey? that going from the jingle biz, which was quite a lucrative profession because you get paid residuals. So every time a commercial that you wrote the music for runs, you get paid. Certainly if you sing on it. So every time it's on TV or radio, the agency writes a check and it appears in your mailbox. If you play on a jingle date, you get residuals every 13 weeks. It's like 2/3 or 3/4 of the session fee. So anyway, that was a good business. And when I decided to go into the web biz, again, I thought, you know, at the risk of sounding immodest, I was somewhat prescient in that I was thinking this is going to have sort of global cultural and, business impact. So it might be a cool thing to explore. Mm. And again, my naivete was that they might need music, which they didn't. But what they did need is people who knew how to run teams and manage to a delivery date and deal with a budget and a client. Mm. So those skills I was able to transfer from the jingle biz to the web biz. But that was probably the leanest stretch in between.
Yeah, I'm in a way I'm glad you said that, because in my head that was the hardest jump because they were just so vastly different. But I love how you're even picking out the transferable skills from music and jingles into computing and I think that's very interesting and what we'll come on to. And before we leave the jingles to one side, so two questions. What is your most famous jingle that you've done? And then what's also your favorite?
Okay. So probably the most famous one, I actually didn't write, but I played bass and sang on it. And it was the first jingle for Kit Kat. It goes like this. Give me a break. Give me a break. Break me off a piece of that Kit Kat bar.
I love it.
So that ran for years. And, actually, with the funny story is we cut the track and then got ready to pack up and leave. So the way the process works, right, is the band plays and then the singers come in and sing.
Yeah.
So we cut the track and we're getting ready to leave. And the producer comes in, who's a friend of mine. That's why he hired me to play on it, the writer and producer. He said the agency wants to hear what you guys sound like singing, you, the band, because they want it to be kind of rough and ready and street kind of vibe. So we're like, sure, well, because we knew what the outcome might be. Yeah. Like, sure, we're happy to, we can sing. So we did it, and then we left, and the jingle singers came in, who are needless to say terrifying. I mean, they sound amazing, and they sight read incredibly, and they work all the time. So they we didn't think much of it. And the next day, some of us had a date somewhere else at a studio in New York. Cut the track, getting ready to leave. And some of the jingle singers from the Kit Kat date came in and said, you guys went on the contract. You're going to make a ton of money. They used your track and not ours.
Wow.
We're pissed. So that's one. And then I wrote some jingles that never really, were like huge, but I wrote one for Office Max. That was kind of cool. Like a rock and roll pop song. Yeah. Office Max. Yeah. We're taking it to the max. It was like a Staples kind of a store,
Yeah. 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 And how long were you doing this for? Because you said you were 40, is that right? Before you started going into the web stuff?
Yeah, 40 is when I had my first job where I had to be somewhere like at 9 o'clock and I had a key to open a door.
Yeah. It was like, and was that not really hard? Because was there anything that was pressuring you to get out of the jingles?
Well, I mean, to be honest, when I first started doing dates, like sessions as a player, right, it was fun. And I mean, it's high pressure. It's got to sound like a record by the third time you have read through it. You got to play with a click track. It's got to be in tune. We got to play a lot of different styles. I mean, I did sessions with some really heavyweight players, Steve Gadd and Dave Weckl. I mean, sort of legendary players that do those dates. I mean, used to. But the thing is, I quickly realized that the people on the other side of the glass, if you know how studios work, right, there's a control room and then there's a studio. So the people on the other side of the glass, the writers and producers, were the ones in charge and, by intimation, making more money, making a good living and not having to hustle as hard. I mean, it's a different hustle. But so that's why I sort of tried to move up the value chain. And then as a meta lesson too, I would say to all you career dads, I mean, that's a general takeaway from my multiple careers. Try to move up the value chain. It's a model that applies in the music business, but it applies in every business, really.
Yeah.
You know, acquire skills, get into a management role or a role where you're leading a team or where you're interacting with a client and an internal team, or, you know, take your learnings and apply them to deliver more value. And then, again, the implication is you'll be more valuable in the work marketplace, or employee marketplace, if you will. Yeah. And your odds of making more money and being more successful and, in theory, being more fulfilled are better.
Yeah, I think that's really, really good advice. It's something that I've definitely tried to do in my career to date. And it's so far, I think, served me quite well. So really, really, really good advice. And so, because you've got, have you got two children?
I just have one.
You have one. Okay.
We started late in all candor. We sort of had our retirement first. We lived in Manhattan for 16 years.
Yeah.
And I loved it. We lived in a loft in Soho and then had a loft down near the seaport.
Yeah.
And my long-suffering wife, for the record, career dads, has been with me through the whole thing. We celebrated our 46th anniversary on Monday.
Wow.
Me meeting her at the Rungovian Embassy, which was a bar in Trumansburg, New York, where I was living. That's where McKendree Spring, the band I was playing with, that's where our home base was. So.
Wow.
Anyway, she's been very patient.
Right. So, I mean, that's amazing first. And so so when, how old were you then when you had your child?
So we had a child, I think I turned 42.
Okay.
A couple weeks after he was born. So he's 28.
Right.
And again, a career dad aside, but, I was like a hotshot musician, jingle composer in New York. And actually my wife worked at the Museum of Holography and was selling real estate, in fact, at the time, sort of a real estate boom in the late 80s in New York. But we had a baby and she was like, I'm not doing this in New York.
Yeah.
We're out of here. So, you know, it's a typical pattern, career dads. I'm sure you've seen this movie or you may see it at some point. But so we bought a house in Connecticut, you know, sort of within commuting distance.
Yeah.
And we moved from this beautiful duplex loft in Lower Manhattan on a Saturday. And Monday I was commuting back into Manhattan from New Canaan, Connecticut on Metro North. And it was like, and it's been fine. I mean, it was a long trip in and out of the city, but you know, we raised our son out here in the Woodburbs and,
I mean, it all worked out. But I kind of have, or pre-COVID had the best of both worlds where it would be a couple of days in London, a couple of days, around, there's an office close to my house here and then a day or two from home. And that was kind of my average week, which was fantastic. But how, you know, living in New York for so long and built, you know, in such a thriving community, especially within that music scene, how was it? I know you were kind of at a point in your life where you weren't necessarily leaving that, but you were transitioning into your next career. But how was it, as you say, to pack up on a Friday, Saturday, and then commute back in on the Monday? How was that for you?
Well, it was challenging for sure. I mean, but again, you know, the meta perspective was it was the right thing to do for our family.
Yeah.
So again, in the context of career dads, right? So I had to sacrifice, but my wife was here in the house with our baby, and it's a safe, we live at the end of a country lane. It's a very safe, very sweet town. And I was able to get into New York in and out, you know, fairly easily. I mean, the Metro North trains are good. They're clean. They're fast. They're reliable. Mm-hmm. And actually, I was working in the jingle biz at the time at this jingle house. So it wasn't like I was going in and doing gigs and kind of running around New York like I had been doing. Because, I mean, I used to play. At one point, I was in like a dozen different bands in the city. Everything from like jazz to R&B to punk to country western. I mean, it was, you know, I subbed on Broadway. I was in the pit for Cats for a while. I did Big River. I played with an Irish band. I mean, you know, when you're a musician, you do whatever pays the bills. So that's what I did.
And so now you say, you know, you've had eight careers so far, which I like. You're not done. And what you're doing now is you run, as you have a website, improvising careers.
Yeah.
And let's talk about that. So I guess what again, two questions. what motivated you to start Improvising Careers? And secondly, why that name?
The sort of catalyst was a request from my alma mater, Bennington College, in Vermont, to come back and deliver a keynote speech to kick off a series of senior week activities. And this is probably 10 years ago now, so close to that. And as I began to reflect on what I'd done since I graduated from Bennington, and I'd been doing some research on career paths and the impact of global economics on jobs and business transformation, changing skill needs and that kind of stuff. I was sort of a closet economist, if you will. It sort of came to me that with all lack of honesty, I was somewhat the poster child for the way today's learners are going to be working.
Right.
So I put together this talk kind of describing my careers and then some sort of visionary slash aspirational slash futurist perspective on what they, these seniors, might be doing out in the real world. And it just sort of evolved from there. And I thought Improvising Careers, since I'm a musician, I still do gigs. I did a gig last Friday, actually, nice, with Otis and the Hurricanes, my Louisiana R&B band. But improvising is kind of what it takes. That's the model, right? Where you have some skills, but you're not quite sure how it's going to turn out exactly. Mm-hmm. So you take what you need, what you know, and then by listening, in this case for careers, like watching what the marketplace is doing, how workforce trends are changing, what business and economics are dictating in terms of what people are selling, what products and services companies are selling, what people are buying. And using that as guidance to improvise what your next career might be. So that's kind of the genesis of that.
I love it, partly because I think it takes a little of the anxiety I have away, because I'm someone that I know, I've got this ambition. I know that I want to achieve and feel like I'm on the path to doing that. But if you said to me, right, what is it? What is that end thing that you want to do? I'd go, I don't know. Because I didn't know that I wanted to do this. And this is really cool. And so I'm looking forward to kind of stumbling into the next thing that I didn't know what I wanted to do and finding that really cool. So I've definitely had an improvised career so far. And I think, yeah, the thing that I really hang on to are the skills, both hard and soft, as in, yes, I've got those technical business marketing skills, but the more soft people, leadership development, or at least I hope I have the skills. And I think, merge those together and hopefully that with an inquisitive mind is going to set me up for the future. But how do you feel around people who kind of don't know what they want to do and feel that they just fall into things versus the people who say you have to have a plan, you have to know what the next thing is? Is there merit for both of those?
Well, I think you have to be prepared to realize that you don't know what's going to happen.
Okay.
That you're going to do interesting things, and you may or may not have some sense of what they are, and they will certainly require some level of skills transfer. You'll take some of what you know how to do now and apply it in a new setting, but there always is going to be some new skills that you're going to have to learn to move into whatever your next role might be, and then the one after that. So I actually recently posted a blog on LinkedIn, and I encourage people to check it out. It's one of my key aphora or mantra, if you will, and that is chase the maelstrom, find the chaos, go for the mayhem. And the implication is, like, go where they don't know what it is yet. Okay. Like, be constantly, and I say this to career dads, right? No matter where you are in your set of improvised careers, like, look for what's next. And at the risk of sounding, maudlin or whatever, we were in the midst of a crisis for sure, the pandemic and the economic meltdown. But I was just on a CNBC small business playbook session this morning, and people like Gary Vaynerchuk, I don't know if your listeners know who he is. He's a sort of social media guru.
Very, very familiar with right? Gary Vee.
Gary Vee. So he was on, and he and as well as the other speakers were saying, especially to small business, look at this as an opportunity. I mean, education is going to be transformed. you know, business interaction. I mean, we're doing Zoom calls and you know, new ways to sort of share webinars, on and on with the endless webinars. You know, lots of ways that this kind of crisis, telehealth. I mean, I was just on a call with my doctor yesterday. That's a transformational opportunity. View these as opportunities. So again, back to the chase to maelstrom, like, how are people rethinking how existing or historically effective processes are being upended or transformed? Yeah. And they represent opportunities. I mean, they do. So
yeah,
I would encourage career devs to look for what's the next thing. And even in your, you know, in whatever space you, career dad writ large, find yourself in, how is your business being transformed by this crisis? I mean, and what can you do to help drive the business model by coming up with innovative solutions to this, these crazy times? And they are crazy, man.
I've really enjoyed seeing some of the real winners in business of who are just pivoting and doing things differently. I know there was one video I saw of a company that had, they were kind of like a little pop-up faux bun company, and they were like, oh, what are we gonna do? And I think this actually might have been a Gary V video, and you know, his thing was, it was Tea with Gary V, one, and it was well, actually, can you teach people to make this stuff at home and go to making, you know, making the kits that get sent out in the post, and you go from being this little cool, you know, pop-up food van to a national brand. And it was like, yeah, you know, you can really rethink some of those business opportunities that in a way have always been there. We've just never looked at them because we haven't had to. And one question that I had for you on this, and I'm channeling my father-in-law now, because he's a huge music enthusiast, spends a lot of time going to gigs. And we were having a conversation about this, you know, how can you replicate things virtually? And you know, the big thing that we got stuck on, he was like, for him, going to an event, being immersed in those people, you know, I can talk about VR and stuff, it's not the same. So what do you think in terms of, as a musician, the whole kind of gig experience in a post COVID world?
Well, so I think it's going to change for sure. It's going to be a hybrid model. I actually went to, it's a video, right? But I attended via video the concert that this EDM DJ did in Fortnite. Are you familiar with that?
Yes.
And it was really, really interesting. Like, you know, he's like, let's dance. Okay. People, you know, it's all that, people's avatars, whatever. And he goes, okay, let's fly. And all the avatars like fly over the stage and in and around the venue. It was like, so, I mean, that's an extreme example. I don't think that kind of event will replace real events. And I think with any luck, I'm certainly hoping, fingers crossed, that we'll get back to live in person, because there's nothing like that. I mean, I hadn't done a gig since late February. We just started playing as a trio outside next to this restaurant in Ridgefield, Connecticut, the next town north of me. And just people love to hear live music, and people love to play live music. So, but I think we're rethinking. We do it kind of in a different configuration. I often use the music analogy in that, like, when the cats in New York on 51st Street started playing bebop, people didn't suddenly stop playing Dixieland. It's just sort of an adjunct, an additional way to express and interact and create and, you know, be together.
Yeah.
So I think we'll see more stuff in virtuals. I mean, the VR thing can be very cool. I mean, a good headset with a well-written program can be really an amazing experience, right? Really feel quite immersive. You're not the same as being in the same space with other carbon-based life forms, I like to say. But I think it's come back because people love to get together and play and listen to music.
Absolutely. I'm just imagining in, you know, 5 years time where this is where we enter into a virtual room and we sit down virtually opposite one another, and it feels probably not too dissimilar to actually being sat in front of one another. I think that would be quite cool.
Absolutely. Along that thread, I was in a webinar with Gerd Lienhardt, who's a futurist who lives in Zurich, but he was saying, I mean, he's speculating, right? But the airlines getting crushed by this, you know, lack of travel, he said, they maybe at some point in the future, you'll go to an airport and you'll get into a pod and be transported virtually to a space on the other side of the planet, and maybe go to the beach or maybe go to a restaurant or, you know, have some virtual interaction. Because he's saying the airlines have the money and to some degree the technology to develop a solution like that. Yeah. I mean, it's pretty far-fetched, but you know, maybe that'll be an alternative to vacation travel.
Maybe a kind of PG version of Ready Player One, something like that would be quite nice.
Yeah, where you could go somewhere and not, you know, you just go to the airport and get into their device and travel and go to the beach, and because they'll be able to recreate sort of all kinds of sensory stimulation to make it feel really quite real, you know.
Yeah, there's a dystopian novel in there somewhere of, you know, that happens, and then is it real, is it not? I think that's
right.
That could be the, that might write that on the whiteboard. So bringing us back on track slightly. So we were talking, and, you know, I kind of brought up at the start of this that your big thing is around, you know, jobs that don't exist. And again, looking at your website, you're talking around, you know, lunar tour guides, and, you know, you think things that you kind of think, wow, that is so far fetched, but actually is it? And so whether it, you know, it is near reality or whether it's just thought provoking, I think, how do we as career dads, but also for our kids, how do we prepare them for jobs that don't exist? It's not like, oh, you want to be an accountant, right? Here's the things you can do to be an accountant. It's kind of, you want to be, well, I don't know. I don't know what that is. Where do you start?
Yeah. Well, so three things that I like to cite when I do my workshops. Research indicates, and there are varying takes on this, but the general research is indicates that 85% of the jobs that today's learners are going to be doing, say, in the next decade, haven't been invented yet.
Right.
So that's one. Two is they're going to use technology that doesn't exist today, that's going to make, you know, carrying around an iPhone look primitive. I always say, you know, get ready for out of the mouths of babes, a comment from your grandchild saying, "Grandpa, you had to carry around a device in your hand to, like, talk to grandma? That's pretty lame." Wow, that must have been a pain in the neck. And then the third thing is, they're going to be using this technology to solve problems that we don't yet know are problems. So that's kind of, you know, context for this. The follow-on thought is that these emerging jobs and careers, right, are taking place at the intersection of historically disconnected disciplines. So what do I mean by that? So one of the examples I cite is nanopharmacy.
Okay.
So there are companies developing devices that are implantable or ingestible or insertable, whatever, that will do things like measure, physiological data, that will deliver pharmacology at the molecular or even atomic level, right? So it'll go right to the cancer tumor or right to the wound and deliver exactly what's needed at the appropriate time in the right place. And there are already companies that are doing this, right? So, and again, the connection is, nanomechanics is a big focus. The three chemists who won the Nobel Prize a couple of years ago won it for nanomachines, building machines at the nanoscale, right? And so you're going to have to combine that with people developing new approaches to pharmacology. And we're seeing an incredible focus on development of vaccines, right, and cures for COVID. So that kind of accelerated science process is only going to make the arrival of these kinds of nanopharmaceutical ingestible implantable devices, you know, happen sooner than later. So that's one example. I mean, there are other things like combining. One of my favorites is when I talk to kids, they say, anybody into astrophysics and hospitality? Usually nobody raises their hand. Yeah. But the idea is that there's a company called Orion Spar, and they're proposing to put up a version of the International Space Station that is a hotel. And it'll be like a four days of circling the Earth at 17,000 miles an hour with, I think, four guests and two crew. So I say to these kids, well, so one of the things you're going to have to learn is, how do you mix and serve a martini in microgravity?
Yeah.
That's going to be some new skill.
Someone's going to have to do that job, right?
Someone is. That's a new job, right? Yeah. And they're talking about going to the moon, right, to set up some kind of colony and or mining, you know, instantiation. So the next logical extrapolation is tourism, right? So someone who understands and is fascinated by lunar geology, but also has people skills, knows how to get the kid with the runny nose to stop crying or whatever. And so again, combining skills that some of which exist and some don't.
My question would be, you know, if someone was listening to this, they'd be like, I want to be a lunar tour guide. And they do their research, and it kind of never happens because it doesn't exist. You know, how much should people be focused on doing a job that does exist today versus having an eye on a job that doesn't? Because there's a difference between something that's new and emerging, like voice marketing, versus something that just isn't even on the peripherals of our vision because we can't even comprehend it yet. So where do you think people should spend their time between we understand it now, we can see it coming in, and got no idea?
I mean, everyone has a different level of comfort with risk, a different proclivity around what they think is viable. So I think it's, you know, there isn't sort of a blanket answer to that question. But I would say, as a general rule, my admonition, again, to colleagues, especially new hires at IBM, was always, once you're comfortable in your job, like after 18 months, start looking for your next job.
Yeah.
And again, the idea that the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics says today's learners are going to have 8 to 10 jobs by the time they're 38.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a public sector data point. I mean, they have no vested interest in the outcome, or they're not trying to sell anything with that data.
Yeah.
So now that's an average, right? I mean, you know, that's the mean. There's going to be more and less depending on, again, your personality, your level of interest, your ambition, whatever.
Yeah.
I would say at the very minimum, people, career dads in whatever job you're in now, be thinking about what's coming next. Again, chase the maelstrom. Like, be aware that it's going to change. You know, innovative, successful companies are always looking for people who can help them drive the transformation of their portfolio of products and services, right? And it's going to change faster and faster. And they're looking for people who are ready to contribute and help them drive the business model and make innovative changes to the to deal with the addressable opportunity in the market, right?
Yeah.
Come up with the next iPhone or the next VR headset or the next COVID vaccine or whatever it might be, right?
Yeah.
I would say for the ones who are maybe more ambitious, if you skew more toward creative or less risk averse, and have an interest in taking on non-trivial challenges, I would say think about who's the company that's going to be setting up the lunar tour guide training.
Yeah.
And maybe you start a company, and maybe incrementally. So an incremental step might be orienting people who work for SpaceX or for Virgin Galactic, right? Because space tourism is about to take a major leap forward. Now that the Crew Dragon has proven we can, you know, the private sector can send astronauts to and from the space station, then that next logical, you know, extrapolation of that is space tourism. And so maybe you're not a lunar tour guide, but maybe you're a SpaceX tour guide for low Earth orbit excursions.
Yeah.
Right?
You touched on IBM, and I know because I do my research, when you worked at IBM, you were involved in virtual worlds. How did you get into virtual worlds?
Well, so actually, here's how it happened. So I was having what we call at IBM an informational interview. Just to remind your listeners, I was at IBM for 15 years, a long time, decade and a half. I mean, I did a lot of different things, but it was an amazing experience, needless to say. But I went to speak with this gentleman, Irving Vodowsky Berger. I don't know if your listeners know who he is, but he was one of the first sort of internet big thinkers at IBM. And he's a sort of adjunct professor at MIT and at Yale. And he writes a blog for CIO and for the Wall Street Journal. Really smart, interesting guy. But he was on his way out. He was about to retire. And he said, you should check out what this guy, Ian Hughes, is doing at the IBM Research Lab in London. They're exploring virtual worlds, and I think you would find it interesting because you seem like a creative guy who's interested in new technology. So anyway, I hooked up with this group, and as I mentioned before, there were like 5,000 members of what we call the Virtual Universe Community. And this is like 2007. And this then CEO, Sam Palmisano, allocated $10 million to create what he called an emerging business opportunity, EBO, to explore if there was, you know, a business model in virtual worlds and in Second Life specifically. So we built instantiations for Deutsche Bank and for Circuit City and for a bunch of other clients and, you know, explored whether we could actually make money, you know, selling services and building environments for IBM customers. It was fun. It was moderately successful. There were lots of different challenges around it, not the least of which was the level of service that Linden Labs, the owner of Second Life, was able to provide us. I mean, IBM is, you know, 430,000 people in 190 countries around the world, and they're like half a dozen like ex-hippies in like a loft in San Francisco. I mean, I'm being facetious. They had a smart team, but for various reasons, they shut it down after a couple of years.
Yeah.
But I did a lot of, we did events. As I mentioned before, I was a concierge and a greeter at an IBM Academy of Technology event that we ran in Second Life, and the topic was virtual worlds. Mm. So there were keynote speakers and plenary sessions and poster sessions, and there was a recreational area with jet skis and a, you know, treehouse and picnic table and virtual beers.
So it's cool.
I was into it. When I was working at IBM and involved in virtual worlds, I had in real life, IRL, I had a blue tick coonhound, which is a southern hunting dog, long ears, long legs, real loud. So I tracked down a woman in Second Life who made animals and sent her a bunch of pictures, and she created a copy of Zoe, my blue tick coonhound, in Second Life, and with a bunch of props. She had like a feeding bowl and a bed, and she had, I think, half a dozen poses. She would sit, lie down, she would bawl, she would bark, she would follow me, like I could, you know, set a setting so she would walk alongside me, heel when I was, my avatar was walking around Second Life. And I paid, I probably paid her like $50 or something.
Yeah,
but it was cool. And the dog lived in my office. I had an AirPod or whatever above one of IBM's island. At an office. Anyway.
I love that. There was, when I was at university, one of my friends, instead of getting, quote, a real job, he used to play this game, EverQuest, and he leveled up people's characters for cash. That was his, and he was like, people are paying me to play, you know, like $300, like to, you know, to end level their characters. And he's like, this will take me a week. So he's making good money. And I love that. And I think, you know, to bring that into today, so I'm speaking at an event in a couple of months that was meant to be physical in London, but it's not. And it's all virtual. And I thought, oh, a virtual event for the day, that could be. I've seen a demo of this thing. And I don't know if you're ever familiar with Habbo Hotel or anything back in the day.
So
if you imagine Habbo Hotel, and for you, the listeners, kind of, if you think of The Sims, but a bit of a hotel scenario, you can walk around, you have a room, you can build it. So this conference, this virtual conference, is that you have your avatar, I guess a bit like Second Life, and you can walk, you can meet, you can talk, you can links off to the web for people's bios. But then when you go into the lecture theaters and you all sit down as your avatars, it slowly zooms into the screen, and then boom, here we are giving a live talk, live Q&A. The talk ends, it zooms back out, and we go back to our avatars and go for a networking coffee.
Yeah.
I'm really excited by this.
Yeah. Well, so I recently was in a virtual space called Verbella. Well, there it's run by, I think it's run by like a real estate company in California, but it's sort of like Second Life, but toned down. I mean, you can't fly, you can't really, you can sort of teleport. But it's pretty simple. It's not a huge client. And they've been running events in there. I sort of went in there and explored, because I'm going to be an MC for a virtual conference on quantum technologies in October. And we're talking about maybe doing one activity in this virtual space.
Wow.
You know, and they have like conference rooms, and they have small meeting rooms. And like Second Life, you can configure it with a click of a mouse, you know, make it classroom or round tables or, you know, whatever. Yeah, Verbella, it was pretty cool.
Hello.
last question that I wanted to ask you was, what do you say to someone who gets asked that, oh, you know, what is a good response for someone who gets asked, where do you see yourself in 5 years? What's a good way of responding to that? And then secondly, where do you see yourself in 5 years?
Well, so, okay. So the first question, I think if people ask you that question, career dad listeners, I would say keep it bordering on metaphysical and or philosophical, right? So an answer might be, I'll be doing something really, really interesting and I have no idea what it is. And hopefully it'll be doing something that's not only interesting, but has impact both from a business perspective, obviously, because you got to make money to fund a business, but also implications around sort of global, cultural and societal impact. And then for me, I don't know. I mean, I've been working on a book for a while. I'm hoping to have it finished and published within the year, maybe. I'm sort of outlining what I call it my future career toolkit. Again, I could put a plug in for my course on LinkedIn Learning, right? It's the course is called Future Proofing Your Data Science Career, but the core of it is what I call the Future Career Toolkit. It's something I developed over, you know, after codifying how I navigated these multiple careers. And there are three elements: voice, antenna, and mesh. The voice exercise lets you sort of identify your brand, if you will, your product description, using triggers like semantic intuition kinds of tools. You know, you pick a book, a movie, a TV show, a game, and what characteristic resonates with you. The antenna piece is looking out for sources. Where are conversations going on? What are the channels where people or companies or organizations are talking about the topic you're interested in? And then the mesh piece is kind of a three-dimensional data visualization exercise, your network of networks, like tracking down the actual people and or companies or organizations who are doing interesting stuff that you might want to do in your next job or the job after that, and reaching for them. I mean, LinkedIn is the key tool, right? That's the lingua franca these days. And that's sort of the process. So I encourage career dads to take a look. Even if you're not into data science necessarily, you could just go to this course and check out the central construct around the Future Career Toolkit. But in terms of me, I'd love to be doing more talking and presenting. I mean, I love running workshops and helping provide guidance. I mean, it's the adage to, you know, learn, earn, return. So I'm definitely in the return phase here.
Again, Chris, just to thank you so, so much for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you.
Well, thank you, Dan. And good luck to all you career dads. And being a dad is the best part of it, right? That's the real job. That's the most important job.
Absolutely. That's the career that endures throughout.
Exactly. For sure.
That's all we've got time for this week. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Career Dad Show. If you did, have you got 10 seconds to rate the podcast? Maybe you've got 20 and can write a review. I appreciate all of you guys for listening. See you next week. Stay cool, be kind.